I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 till 5 and Saturdays from 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about democracy and how democracy can sometimes fall to the advances of so-called strongmen, to someone like a Mussolini or a Hitler or a Stalin. The book at hand is called Strongman, The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy. It is the contention of the author of this book, Kenneth C. Davis, that democracy, while we might think of it and hope that it is a robust institution, and in some respects, of course, it is also something that can be quite fragile and can fall when we perhaps least expect it, especially when we are complacent about its permanence. And in his book, he examines the somewhat turbulent and difficult history of democracy as it has played out in different places, and he chronicles in particular the ascendance to power of five of history's most infamous dictators. And it is a fascinating look at who we allow to lead us and what it takes for someone to become such a strong man, and in a sense, what is required of the people. In terms of accepting that rise to power. I mean, are they willing accomplices? What is that relationship? It's a series of complicated and challenging questions, very impressively approached in this meticulously researched and very well-written book, again titled Strongman, The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy, published by Henry Holt and Company. Kenneth C. Davis is a New York Times best-selling author of, among other things, America's Hidden History and Don't Know Much About History, which, of course, set into existence a series of books for both adults and young readers. Kenneth C. Davis, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. It is a great pleasure to be with you, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Glad we can have this conversation. One of the things that you take a little time to do in your book, and I'm glad that you do, is you take some time to help us maybe gain a better understanding of what we mean by democracy and the way in which the term democracy can be used in different ways and can sometimes be rather carelessly applied in terms of describing governments. Let's begin with sort of a brief primer on what we are talking about when we are talking about democracy in its most proper sense, as well as the way in which democracy has tended to exist in the real world.
Thank you, Craig. It's one of those words that we toss around and we don't really think too much about it, and we certainly take it for granted to a great deal. So the book actually opens up with how quickly democracy can die in a constitutional democracy, and I use the example of Hitler's Germany, and then I actually give a history of this idea. We are talking about something that certainly in the Western world, the concept of democracy, which, by the way, the word is nowhere mentioned either in the Declaration of Independence nor in the Constitution. That surprises an awful lot of people. But this is an old idea, at least 2,500 years old, when we think of going back to Athens. The word democracy is Greek in derivation, and it simply means the power of the people. Many people contrast it with a republic, and I talk about the rise of the Roman Republic. If democracy is Greek for power of the people, republic comes from the Latin and also means of the people. So there are two different terms that are drawing on the same idea. Now, the founding fathers of this country, and I detail this briefly at the opening of the book to give people a sense of the history, the founding fathers of this country believed in the notion of a republic. They believed in the notion of the power of the people, but they feared democracy in many respects. They thought that the best case in the past had been the Roman Republic. That's one of the reasons why one of the houses of Congress is called the Senate. The word president is also a word drawn from the Latin. So this was a very influential period in American history in evolving what would become our Constitution. But these men were worried about the power of the people getting to be too strong, and that's why at every step along the way, they introduced the notion of checks and balances, that they wanted to maintain balance of power between the separate arms of government. And democracy was very limited under the original Constitution in 1787, including the fact that they did not want the people to directly elect the president. That is why we have an electoral college, very much a question of the moment.
You write in this early chapter, by embracing shared powers under a republic, the framers of the Constitution embarked in 1787 on a bold experiment in government, but their idealism was tempered by their fears of an unruly mob on one hand or a tyrant on the other. I think that's one of the most fascinating things about this, and I'm not sure I ever really saw that clearly until I read this portion of your book, that there were, in a sense, two different fears at play as the framers of the Constitution were doing their hard work. And that really helps us understand why it was such a difficult process. And in a sense, it also helps explain, in some ways, both the robustness and the fragility of our government as it has been put together, because it was knit together as a careful and maybe untidy compromise in light of two different fears of two very different threats.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, Elbridge Gerry, whose name comes down to us as gerrymandering, also a topic much in the news, said at the Constitutional Convention, the evils we experience flow from the excess of democracy. They did think that the notion of the people making the decisions was one step removed from mob rule. On the other hand, they understood and feared the power of a single man given too much power. And the great debate in the Constitution, among the great debates in the Constitution, was what powers the president would be given, what powers this executive would be given. To name someone commander-in-chief of the army, they realized was a very dangerous, potentially perilous threat. They understood, knowing well the history of the Roman Republic, that the idea of a dictator was part of the Roman Republic. It was a term that was used by the Senate to name a temporary military commander. Eventually, Julius Caesar is named dictator. He's then named a dictator for 10 years, and eventually he's named dictator for life. And they really got nervous when he started to put his picture on the coins. This is when you elevate leadership. A dictator elevates himself from a simple leader to near deity. And the Roman Senate got really nervous once Caesar had taken those moves. So they understood that a strong man could come along. In fact, Plato, going back to ancient Greece, writes that democracy will eventually fall to a tyrant. He predicts this. He gives in his famous The Republic five different forms of government, including a democracy, which he did not think was the perfect form of government. And he thought that eventually a tyrant would come along and replace democracy, which throughout history has often been the case. And this is certainly one of the things that the framers of the Constitution feared most in 1787, and one of the reasons they put in these checks and balances that we all learn about in civics class and don't seem very important until they become very important. Mm.
So at some point in the introduction of the book, you write, "Democracy is a fragile flower." So tell us what is behind those very intriguing words. Democracy is a delicate flower. I think the typical American would probably never put those words together.
I, as a historian, I would say I would, and an American who's been writing and thinking about this a great deal and knows the ups and downs of American history pretty well, I'd have to say that I didn't really contemplate that seriously until recent times, because we have come to accept democracy and the way the United States functioned reasonably well for with many flaws over 230 plus years, is that this idea was not only created but then strengthened over the centuries. If we look at the changes in the American Constitution, all of them that reflect on voting powers lead to more democracy, the opening up of the process to more power of the people, African American men getting the vote, women getting the vote, giving the election of senators a direct vote rather than by the state legislature, which is how it was originally formed, giving Washington, D.C. three electors, because until the 1960s, the people in Washington, D.C. had no voice in the presidency. One that affected me a great deal was getting to vote at 18 in 1972, which I was able to do, and I voted in every election since, I believe. So this is part of the process in America that's led to more democracy, and we've believed in this notion of one person, one vote. But one of the things that I show in the book in the very opening chapter is how quickly democracy can vanish. We are told by the Washington Post that democracy dies in darkness, but this book demonstrates very clearly it often dies in broad daylight, decapitated while thousands of people cheer. And specifically, I point to the two cases of Mussolini, first because he precedes Hitler. Mussolini was elected to the Italian legislature at the time under a constitutional democracy with a monarch. And then he's appointed, named by the king, the prime minister. Within a very short space of time, he moves quickly and decisively with legal authority to stamp out all opposition, all other parties, and create a one-party state under fascism. Similarly, Hitler is brought to power under a constitutional democracy. He had run for president, finishing second to President Hindenburg, a World War I hero in Germany, and is also appointed to the position of chancellor or prime minister, and very, very rapidly moves with legal authority to repress other parties, shut down the presses, eliminate opposition until, in a short time, the Nazi Party is the only party and a flourishing democracy under the Weimar Constitution is destroyed, replaced by perhaps the most notorious strongman of all, but far from the most murderous, both Stalin and Mao, who are also described in this book, exceeded Hitler's worst excesses.
We're speaking with Kenneth C. Davis about his newest book, Strongman, The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy. I don't think we need to spend a whole lot of time on this, but it's a very significant point that you try to kind of chart a long look at the arc of democracy, and you see something very different happening to democracy in the wake of the First World War, after what would seem to be in a general rise in prominence and preponderance, with the end of World War I, a scenario is created in which a number of notable democracies, and we've already named a couple of them, tumble very quickly. Explain what that scenario is that we were left with at the end of the First World War that, in a sense, left some of these major democracies so vulnerable.
It's a really important point, and one of the things I've tried to stress over the years that history doesn't necessarily repeat itself in this Groundhog Day scenario, but we can learn an awful lot from what happened in the past and how it affects the future. And no better example of that than what happened in the aftermath of World War I, which of course ended November 11th, 1918. Woodrow Wilson had taken America into war with the promise that it was a war to defend democracy, which is a somewhat specious claim, so we'll treat that another time. But in the aftermath, when you have the end of these empires around the world, you have the victorious nations coming in and essentially redrawing the maps not only of Europe, but redrawing the maps of the world. And almost every one of these countries that falls to a strongman is something that happens in the aftermath of World War I and what happened in Versailles. So it's a crucial moment in world history and one that still affects us today. Iraq, which is the last of the five stories in this, was a creation of 1919. Redrawing the maps of what had then been called Mesopotamia and the creation of the state that would become known as Iraq. So all of these stories radiated out from this. Mussolini and Hitler were both World War I veterans. It was a shaping experience for them. They took the chaos and the carnage that was the aftermath of the war in their countries and turned it to their advantage. Of course, while World War I is going on, we have the Russian Revolution, a nascent republic in Russia that replaced the Tsar was quickly overthrown, just as it was in China, where, again, the war and the results of the war in 1918 had an impact on China as well. So you have the end of the Chinese Empire, this thousands of year dynasty, and replaced briefly by a republic under Dr. Sun Yat-sen, but that doesn't hold. Of course, there are enormous powers here, and I try and go through each of these quickly, but trying to summarize that these things never happen in a vacuum, that we always must look at the ripples that come out when a large stone is dropped in the pond, and World War I was a large stone.
Right. And of course, what we're talking about here in all of these instances is where a so-called strong man comes along who seems to be offering what the people would, at least on a very visceral level, seem to most desperately want, a sense of order, of bringing chaos under control, of marching forward somehow. And if a population is feeling a certain level of fear, that is exactly the kind of situation in which such a figure is perhaps going to have greatest impact. Is that an oversimplification, or is that, in a sense, the heart of the matter?
No, I don't think it's an oversimplification at all. It's part of the process, and a central part of the process. If we look at sort of the four key early elements in the rise of a strong man, we start with a nationalist and an extreme nationalist who is also a populist or appears to be a populist. It's, you know, a very slippery term. So that person is coming along saying that they want to restore the nation's past glory or greatness, that this nation has been downtrodden, and they have a whole list of grievances for why their nation's greatness has been diminished and it should be returned to its former glory. Mussolini certainly does this by calling upon the glories of ancient Rome. It is no accident. Most people are not aware that the word fascism comes from a Latin term, fasces, that was the symbol of authority in ancient Rome. It was a bundle of rods bound together around an axe head. Mussolini used that symbol to name his party, and that symbol, the fasces, was prominently displayed throughout Italy at the time. You can go to the central train station in Milan today, perhaps the last monument to fascism that that is standing, and see those fasces on the side of that building alongside statues of horses and godlike men. Mussolini trying to restore this grandeur that was ancient Rome. So that's certainly one typical thing. Hitler certainly does the same. Then alongside that, as I said, there's grievances. Usually they are placing blame on a single group, usually an ethnic or religious minority, or a foreign threat, or a particular party. Certainly, we obviously look at Germany and the discussion of the Jews, the discussion of how foreign nations had destroyed Germany in the aftermath of World War One. So this is kind of step two. Then the warning of an emergency, sometimes non-existent, or responding to severe economic distress. Certainly the case both in Germany, in Italy, post-war period, certainly the reason that Mao and Stalin are able to come to power is the extreme economic distress of the people in their country. So these are all themes that these strong men are able to use. And finally, the call for law and order. And eliminating corruption, that one of the reasons that we are in the state we're in is because the leadership has been so corrupt.
The factors that you are talking about in the minds of some would call to mind some of what we are experiencing today. How much is this book crafted in reflection of current events right now in the United States?
Well, let me say right up front, very bluntly, that I don't discuss the current administration or current American politics at all in this book. It's much more a book of history, looking back, and a book that has an eye to the future when the momentary politics will disappear. But you're absolutely right. I don't need to name anyone to say that the four things that I've just pointed out are certainly things that have been part of the appeal of the current president. Then you go on from there to some of the other things that these strong men have done. And I do not want to, you know, say here that I will not label any current American politician with any of these labels that are thrown around much too casually, I think. But when you have attacks upon the free press, when you have attacks upon minority groups, immigrant groups that are part of the appeal, when you have an attack on the courts and the legitimacy of elections, as we have seen, we're in that very, very dangerous waters, and that's why this is very much a cautionary tale for America. You know, the day after the presidential debate a few weeks ago, I was rather astonished to see headlines in the New York Times that say the president is essentially calling into question the legitimacy of the American election system. He's calling into question the legitimacy of the process itself. This is unprecedented in American history, in my experience, and something I think that anyone of any party, of any political affiliation, should be concerned about if we really believe in the ideas that the country is founded upon, that all men are created equal, that we are entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that we, the people, are the ones who have created this government, and we are trying to make a more perfect union out of it.
Mm-hmm. One line that leapt out of to me in the chapter devoted to Benito Mussolini is when you said that some of the people who supported Mussolini in the early going made the misjudgment that they could rein him in. And I think that is a mistake not limited to Mr. Mussolini and his supporters, that in a sense we're talking about strong figures and a certain swath of the population that craves such a leader. But there is also this sense that we can hopefully get this strong leader to do what we want the way we want him to do it. And of course, a strong man, by very definition, is not going to be somebody who is easily bridled or guided.
No, you're absolutely right, and I guess you mentioned Mussolini, and then certainly the case in his example, the same thing was largely true of Adolf Hitler, who was seen as a sort of minor character who people in power, including those in the military, others in the German government at the time, thought that they would put him in as a sort of puppet figure, someone they would easily control. They weren't very impressed with this man. He was a corporal in the army in World War I. He was not well educated. They certainly looked down at him. I think the phrase used throughout history has sometimes been the useful idiot. Neither Mussolini or Hitler, of course, was a useful idiot. They were far more ruthless and scheming and willing to use any means to get accrue the power that they eventually accrued, and that was using means legal and illegal, extreme violence in many cases. Mussolini, as I mentioned, is put into power by the King of Italy, who was a rather feckless individual, and within a very short period of time, he does call another election. That election is riddled by fraud and corruption. A senator gets up in the room in the Italian Senate and decries this election as being fraudulent and corrupt. He disappears the next day and is found murdered a few weeks later. So there's the ruthlessness, the level of violence that follows on these men being put into power by very, very powerful men who think that they have the ability to control this person, and they are tragically and woefully wrong in that case.
It's a powerful book, which ends with a powerful chapter titled Never Again, in which we are called to draw conclusions from some of these painful lessons of history. The book again is titled Strong Man: The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy, published by Henry Holt and Company, and the author, Kenneth C. Davis. Kenneth C. Davis, thank you so much for writing this powerful and important book, and thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thanks so much for having me. For those who are interested to learn more, you can go to my website, don'tknowmuch.com, where I write about this book and my other work, and just always a reminder that, indeed, history matters.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing an interview recorded back in 2010. I can't urge you enough to take in hand a very, very important book called The Enough Moment, Fighting to End Africa's Worst Human Rights Crimes. This is a book which springs out of something called the Enough Project. And this book is co-written by human rights activist John Prendergast and Oscar-nominated actor Don Cheadle. They have worked side by side. But this book is about far more than just their own efforts to curb and ultimately end the violence and brutality which is occurring right now in certain sections of Africa. But it is also the story, the inspiring story, of all kinds of others who have stepped up to this immense challenge, upstanders, as they are called. And some of these are celebrities and people in other ways famous to us, and others are very ordinary citizens, both here and abroad, including, in many respects, the most courageous and important participants at all in this struggle, the citizens of some of these violence-racked countries in Africa itself, who at great risk to themselves and their loved ones are standing tall in this fight against violence. The book, again, is called The Enough Moment, Fighting to End Africa's Worst Human Rights Crimes. It's published by Three Rivers Press. And these two gentlemen collaborated previously on the book Not on Our Watch, The Mission to End Genocide in Darfur and Beyond. And we have John Prendergast with us for the next few minutes to talk about the Enough Project and what this book and his work represent. John Prendergast, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg.
You have been at this for a long, long time. Can you just give us a brief sense of what started you on this road of, in particular, the work which has meant so much to you in Africa?
You know, I was sitting on a lazy boy chair, you know, literally beat up. I had gotten injured and playing basketball, and ankle was on fire, and I'm 20 years old, and I got a whole life plotted out before me that had nothing to do with Africa. And it's a late night, and I didn't have a remote control. It was back in the early 80s. And I didn't, you know, so I'm just watching whatever the heck comes on the TV. And suddenly this panorama, this vista of human misery appears on the screen. And it's the pictures, early pictures from the great Ethiopian famine of the early to mid-1980s. And I just overwhelmed by the scale and scope of what I was seeing on the television. And it was one of these moments where it just clicked. I said, I've got to try to do something about this. It seems to me, living in the most powerful, wealthiest nation on earth, we could potentially do something about such an enormous human crisis. So I literally went. And, you know, the rest for me, for my own life, is history in terms of just becoming committed to the issues and the solutions to some of these problems, solutions that often cost very little. You know, we end up coming in at the end, cleaning up the messes, sending UN peacekeeping troops, sending billions of dollars in humanitarian aid, when all we really needed to do up front was send a few diplomats to help secure a peace agreement. So I've learned a lot over these years about how solutions can happen. I wouldn't have known otherwise if I hadn't gone there and figured it out. And now that Don and I have been going together on these trips, we can hopefully communicate some of these solutions in ways that all of us can get involved in pressing our government to invest in these solutions so we don't have to end up cleaning up the mess.
Explain to our listeners how you and Don Cheadle met for the first time.
Well, Don was just, he finished Hotel Rwanda, and they were screening the film. And they did a screening at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, and we ended up talking afterwards, and actually we were probably talking about the Celtics and Lakers. We're both basketball fanatics, and became friendly. And it turned out that he was interested in learning more about the current situation that most approximated what he experienced during the filming of Hotel Rwanda, which was the genocide in Darfur. So through many many different sort of permutations, we ended up going on a trip together with the guy he actually portrayed in Hotel Rwanda, Paul Roussos of Aguina, the real-life hero of the film. And we went with a group of congressmen, and we found out, you know, we invested some time, went across the border into the areas of Darfur that were racked by genocide. Don's conviction grew, said he had to do something, and so when we came back, we started doing all kinds of action. And then we went back again to Africa together to look at child soldier recruitment. And now we've just kind of forged this partnership, which has led to him being involved in a whole lot of different things and become a real sort of leader in the human rights field.
One of the most deft things you do in this book, I mean, a really tricky balancing act, which I think you and your co-author manage so very well, is balancing the need to tell the story of these horrors and yet balancing that with the story of what has been done, those signs of hope. If for no other reason, I mean, besides simple truthfulness, of making sure that people do not fall back into what you talk about as a very common assumption that too many people make, that Africa is a hopeless continent, that in fact for the terrible things that have occurred there, there are all kinds of tremendous signs of hope and progress. Talk a moment about how important it is that both sides of this story are told.
Well, the great news is that there's all kinds of positive stories that are coming out of Africa. We just never hear them because, you know, when it leads, as we've always heard, you know, in the sort of commercial news industry. So they want to look for the picture of the starving baby, understandably, because people are like riveted by this kind of thing. But the great news is that we got all these cases that we try to tell some of these stories, like, look at, you know, everyone knows Nelson Mandela, and everyone knows that South Africa at some point was, you know, ruled by this racist white supremacist government for many, many years. And because of people's actions all over the world, demanding change, demanding rights and democracy for the people who are the black majority in South Africa, we were able to help globally help bring an end to this apartheid system in South Africa. In the case of the Blood Diamonds, we have an example where Americans and people from around the world who were disgusted by the news and the revelations that our purchase of diamonds in the United States and around the world were actually fueling wars and terrible human rights abuses in three countries in West Africa, ended up creating a system to weed out those blood diamonds, and they ended those wars in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Angola within a couple years of the construction of this program that weeded out the blood diamonds. So we could go on and on about the cases where citizen action actually translated into profound change on the ground in Africa, thousands of miles away, against all odds. And it's the power of people coming together. And now that we have the internet and 21st century sort of political activism, we can organize much more efficiently and effectively and be able to make a difference very directly with our government and with the companies that sell us products that are profiting from this human misery. So I think we can even make a bigger difference now by opening up your laptop, getting online, and getting involved in some of these different organizations, different movements that are focused on bringing about positive change and protecting human rights of people, no matter where they live.
One thing that makes this challenging is, in your words, fighting human rights crimes is messy and inconvenient. How so?
You know, it's an easy thing to sort of get, you know, send $10 that makes sure that it sends a mosquito net or a dose of medicine for a kid in Africa. That's terribly important, and we support that. It's harder to say, let's get involved in trying to address the root causes of why people are in need of all these humanitarian assistance services. And so, yeah, you got to get involved in the politics. You got to get involved in the economics. Turns out that, you know, pretty much all wars around the world since the recorded history have a struggle over power or over greed and money and wealth. And so getting to the root causes of those problems, addressing those root causes, is something America is very good at. American diplomats are very good at. We just have to point them in the right direction and say, you know what? It actually matters to American citizens that we invest in a solution in Darfur. We invest in a solution in Congo. Let's send a few diplomats that back the diplomatic process and negotiate an end to these problems and back it up with American leverage. That's really where the value added of not sending thousands of troops to different places, not sending billions of dollars. It's the good old-fashioned diplomacy, which America has made a great name for itself around the world over the last half century, and we just need to apply those great principles and those great minds to some of these problems, some of these seemingly intractable problems in Africa, and we'll actually make a difference there.
One thing your co-author says, Don Cheadle, that I think was a very helpful insight. He writes at one point, leaders are incentivized to go after objectives for which they can get a quick solution. And you are describing, in terms of getting at the root of certain problems, we're talking about something that is going to take some time.
Exactly. And you know, incentivizing it in a way that, you know, we have people all over the country who write their members of Congress, who get involved in their Facebook pages and do all this kind of stuff. And there's actually a reward, a political reward for a politician who stands up. And there's people in his or her congressional district who say, you know, good job. Thanks for taking that. You didn't have to. Wasn't necessarily that it's a part of your political survival, but you care enough to do that. And so I think a lot of these senators and a lot of these Congress people tell me personally that, you know, it's one of the most satisfying parts of their jobs when they can actually make a difference and then be told by their constituents, thanks for doing that.
You tell us about all kinds of really troubling situations, and you devote an entire chapter to this heartbreaking phenomenon of child soldiering, in which young children are very much against their will brought into the heart of these conflicts. You suggest that this is a real indication of when a society is breaking down, when it treats their own children in this way. And yet you have seen heartwarming, encouraging signs of how some of these children, first traumatized as they have to be, manage to find forgiveness for one another, even in the wake of something so disturbing.
You know, it's amazing how the power of human spirit, you know, I've met so many kids who have been involved in terrible atrocities, forced to kill their brother, forced to stone another kid to death at gunpoint. All these terrible atrocities that their young minds have been exposed to, but there are programs like what they call psychosocial intervention that can help kids deal with some of the things they've had to experience and make a reentry back into society, into peaceful society in which they can become eventually productive members. It requires a little investment, but change can be made. Mm. And the heartening story is that all over the United States, young people are connecting with those kids. There's an Invisible Children movement, it's called, where over a million young people in the United States have banded together to support policies by the U.S. government to end this practice of child soldier recruitment, policies that will support the rehabilitation of some of these kids when they come out of their time in bondage and military service. So really, there are answers, there are solutions to these problems, and as usual, as we've seen in American history, young people in colleges, in high schools, are leading the way in our country for social change.
Hmm. We hear from all kinds of heroes and heroines in this struggle, many of them whose names we do not know, and their stories are so inspiring. And then from a lot of people we do know, Angelina Jolie, Ben Affleck, Martin Sheen, Madeleine Albright, and many others. When you speak with journalist Ann Curry, she says there is a degree of trauma associated with reporting about injustice. There is a degree of trauma that anyone involved with that has to endure. I wonder if you, after all these years, experience much of that yourself. I mean, what is it that allows you to keep going in the face of all that you see and learn about and experience?
That's actually nice of you to ask, Greg. And I think, you know, it does wear on you. Since I was 20 years old, I've been living in or visiting refugee camps and war zones, and I had a bunch of narrow escapes myself. Not terribly unlike some of the veterans, returning soldiers that I talked to from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And so what, you know, what it keeps me going are two things. One is continuously meeting and talking to the survivors of these atrocities in Congo, in Sudan. I just came back with Ashley Judd from a trip to Eastern Congo literally a couple of days ago, and we spent a lot of time with women and girls who had been traumatized by rape, mass rape, and I just, you know, you come back and they're just saying, can you help? Can you do something about this situation we're in? So I just come back so energized. You know, I know what my mandate is as a human being. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, I think, you know, it's really just knowing that there are all these success stories, that in fact, if we just stick with it and find the right key to the solution, that we can actually see change. And so I'm very, very hopeful, actually, that the situations that we're dealing with in this book, particularly the wars in Congo and Sudan, which are the two biggest wars in the world, can come to an end, and the American government can play a role diplomatically in bringing that to an end. And that will happen if people like us stand up and say it matters to us that America's voice is heard in the context of these conflicts.
In our last minute, you grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana, I believe. As a young man growing up, was there any hint that this was ahead for you?
You know, I got a detention. I used to get detention slips all the time in high school, and a little bit of a troublemaker. And one time, this teacher was so exasperated with me, she had a bunch of literature, and she threw it down on the desk and said, read this. And it was these stories. It was from Amnesty International and Bread for the World and these other national organizations, and they were the little pamphlets, you know, that they were giving out. And I read about these kids who were, you know, in soldierdom, and about people who had been tortured and all this stuff, and I was just overwhelmed. So it planted a little seed. That teacher had no idea. In fact, I've doubled back and told her about it. That no idea that that seed was planted, and that, you know, one day when I saw those pictures of the Ethiopian famine, I realized I had to do something. That's when, you know, those little seeds had been planted. So that was pretty much the only sort of precursor that actually foreshadowed where I would end up the rest of my life.
The book is The Enough Moment, Fighting to End Africa's Worst Human Rights Crimes. It's published by Three Rivers Press, now in paperback, co-authored by Don Cheadle and John Prendergast. John Prendergast, an inspiring privilege for me to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thanks for caring so much, Greg.
Once again, this interview with John Prendergast was recorded back in 2010. 10 years later, the Enough Project is still doing its good work in the continent of Africa. And more information about that work or how you can be involved in it can be found at their website, which is enoughproject.org. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, my interview with Walter Koenig. He played Ensign Pavel Chekhov in the television series Star Trek, the original series. And Walter Koenig, a gifted writer, has written a very intriguing memoir about his long career called Beaming Up and Getting Off: Life Before and Beyond Star Trek. You'll be hearing a portion of that long conversation on tomorrow's Morning Show. On Wednesday, Dr. Art Sear joins us for his analysis of current events. On Thursday, Brian Stile and Roger Pollack contending for the first congressional district seat. On Friday, a preview of what is being offered up this weekend by the Choral Arts Society and a conversation with Kenosha Unified's Holly Stanfield. Support for The Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, now reopened for in-store shopping Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, 11 to 5, Saturdays, 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask. And